Good morning. Welcome to church this morning. My name is Mike Acharya, and I've been part of this church for nearly 2 years. In the pulpit this morning, it is my esteem honor to have my father, Mr. Anand Bhattacharya, in the pulpit. My father was born in Calcutta, India. He went to college in India and became an electrical engineer. In 1969, he, my mom, and I was 4 years old at the time, so this is a long time ago, immigrated to the United States, and my father reestablished his career in the States. My father retired 20 years ago, and after his retirement, he followed his passion for Hinduism and Indian culture. The Kansas City Star, the religious section, has for many years opened up its pages to religious leaders, not only in the Kansas City community, but the entire world, to answer religious questions that it posts. My father has been consistently chosen to offer the Hindu perspective on those questions. So, as a open-minded church of knowledge seekers that we have here today, I think we will get a unique and learned perspective on Hinduism. You are invited to stay following this worship service for fellowship, conversation, and refreshments in the fellowship hall, the Kate Worker Room, just behind these doors. If you are a newcomer here this morning, we extend to you a special welcome and hope that if this is your first time to visit, you'll consider entering your name on one of the visitor cards that can be found in the back of the hymnal and placing the card in the offering plate or handing it to an usher. If you do that, we'll send you our church newsletter for the next 3 months to let you know about all the programs and activities going on in the church. Also, if you're visiting here for the first time and you have children with you, we want to let you know that your children may certainly stay with you during the service today, but we do have a professionally staffed nursery for infants and young children. If you'd like to learn more about this church and about Unitarian Universalism, please visit the information display in the fellowship hall where there will be pamphlets, newsletters, and other visitor information that you are most certainly welcome to take home with you. Now I invite you to turn to your neighbors and greet them, especially the ones that you don't know yet. If you have a short announcement for the good of the church, please come to the microphone.
Morning. We have one more week collecting for the community Christmas collection for the United Way. I know it seems weird, but they are collecting that big white box on the 12th, which is a Thursday. So that means next week is the last weekend to bring stuff for that. They are looking for new toys for all ages, new winter clothing for all ages, and personal care items. So if you could, if you are going to be here for a meeting during the week, drop something off, or next weekend, it would be really appreciated. Thanks.
Okay. Now I invite you to the microphone and share briefly any joys or milestones you may bring with you to church this morning. Notice there will be time to share concerns and sorrows in just a few moments.
Hi, I'm Ben. I'm going to turn 11 on December 5th.
Yay! Okay, so now I invite you to move to the microphone and share briefly any sorrows or concerns you may bring to church with you this morning. Okay. The prelude begins our worship service as Rowan lights our chalice. This is a reading from Genesis 28. Surely the Lord is in this place, and I do not know it. How awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. Our first hymn is number 298, Wake Now, My Senses. 298. It'd be in the gray hymnal. Oh, stand, if you're willing and able. Join in responsive reading 612 in your gray hymnal. It's called Fearful Joy. It's by an Indian poet by the name of Rabindranath Tagore. Is it beyond thee to be glad with the gladness of this rhythm, to be tossed and lost and broken in the whirl of this fearful joy?
All things are shown, shall not, they will not be mine, no
keeping step with that restless, rapid music, seasons come dancing and passing away. Please be seated. We have been greatly blessed. Let us now give generously so that others might be blessed by the work of this church. The morning's offering will now be given and received. Can I get all the children to come up here for a story? Let me ask you guys a quick question and see if you guys can give me an answer. Have you guys ever really, 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 really wanted something, and that's all you could think about, and, oh, God, if I could just get this thing, everything will be wonderful. But then, after you got it, no, that's not the most wonderful, or, you know, there's something else more wonderful. Has that ever happened to anybody here? Anybody at all? What happened to you? Can you give an example?
We had a toy bow that came with three suction cup arrows, and I really wanted it, and whenever I tried to fire it, the string got loose at it.
That's happened to me before with toys as well. Anybody else wants to share? No? Okay. You want to share? Go ahead.
I got Minecraft, but then I found out about Terraria.
Well, I'm going to tell a story, and I'm sure, and I apologize to my mom and dad, because I'm going to butcher this.
I really had to buy.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, there you go. Well, when you need that, there's no substitute. Okay, but I'm going to tell you a story. It's actually one of my more favorite stories, but I'm going to butcher it, so I apologize. It's an old Indian story, and I'm going to get the names all wrong, but you get the general concept. There was this great king, King Akbar, who was a conqueror. What he wanted was material wealth, and he wanted land, he wanted power. And that's what he was after. He was ready to just conquer the known world. That's all he wanted. That's what adults call fixated. You heard that word, fixated? That's all he wanted to do. And so that's what he did. He conquered every known person. He got all the riches of the land. He got everything. And at the time, gold was like the thing to have, right? Because that's how you kept your power. That's how you kept your military. That's how you build things. So gold was a really big thing. So one day he's talking to the wise man, King Akbar, and he goes, "Did I not conquer everything?" And normally the wise man is, you know, very responsive to him, but he's very honest. He goes, "No, sir, you have not conquered everything." And King Akbar was mad. He was like, "What are you talking about? I have conquered everything. I conquered everything." He goes, "No, you haven't, because I've been told that there is this person out there who has this stone that whenever he could touch anything and it turns to gold. And he can use that stone anywhere, anytime." And King Akbar started thinking, "Oh my God. Not only can he outdo me in my gold, then he can raise his own military. He can conquer me. Let's find this person." And so he set out for a long journey to find this person. And finally, after a long time, he finally found this person sitting on the beach, meditating. And he goes, that's the person. Let's catch him by surprise." And he so he'd send his troops over there. He didn't know how much power he had, so he had just send the entire troops. He surrounded this man. And he goes, "Sir, I've been told this story about you having this stone that can turn anything into gold. Is this true?" The man looked up. "That is true." "Well, where is this? I demand you give it to me." "Right here." He picked it up from the sand that's near the beach. He was sitting right by the beach. "It's right here." He thought, okay, now he's going to attack me with it, or he's going to turn me into gold, or he's going to... He goes, "Well, I demand to have it." The man kind of looked at him. He goes, "Okay." He just handed it to the king. And he goes, "So what are you going to do now that you no longer have it?" He said, "I'm going to sit here, I'm going to meditate, and I'm going to think about truth and about God and what's real." "Okay, you do that. Great." So King Akbar takes his and sends it away. And he uses it. Yeah, sure enough, he touches a tree, it turns to gold, and now he has more than enough. About a year later, Akbar, by himself, no military, comes back. And he sits down next to this man. Shredded clothes and everything. Akbar sits down next to him. He goes, "Your Highness, what are you doing here?" He goes, "You had this thing. You could have had that power anytime you wanted. But you must have something greater than that gold. You must have something greater than power. Something greater than wealth. Something greater than everything." He goes, "I do. And that is spiritualism." And that's the story. So What are you supposed to be doing today? What are the two things you all are supposed to be doing today? Have fun and learn something. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's my pleasure to come here and make a presentation on Hinduism. First of all, I want to thank my son to give such a good introduction. I also want to introduce my wife of 52 years, Dipti. And of course, you already know my daughter-in-law, Sangeeta, and two handsome grandkids, Roman and Aaron. Okay. Once again, it's my pleasure to come here and make this presentation on Hinduism. First of all, I want to say a short prayer. Can you all hear me? I want to say a short prayer, first in Sanskrit, and then the English translation. Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhina Sarve Shantu Niramaya Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kashchit Dukkham Apnuvat Om Shantihi, Shantihi, Shantihi. The English translation is, by the grace of God, let happiness be unto all. Let perfect health be unto all. May we all see what is good. May all be free from suffering. Peace, peace, peace. Hinduism is one of the major religions of the world. There are about 1 billion people who identify themselves as Hindus. And almost 80% of them live in India. In the United States, I believe Hindu population is about 1.5 million. So it is less than 0.5% of the total population. But this population is growing. Hinduism is one of the oldest religions of the world. And according to many scholars, it is the oldest living religion today. It's not a historical religion in the sense that many major religions were founded at some point of human history. Christianity, for example, Buddhism, Islam, these are examples when they were founded at some point of human history. But Hinduism is not like that. Nobody really knows when this religion was started. But we do know that some of the earliest scriptures of this religion are probably as old as 5,000 years. They were composed about 5,000 years ago. So it's ancient religion. It's very old religion. But it's not a historical religion. It doesn't have a prophet. So sometimes we humorously say, Hinduism is a non-profit religion. Non-profit religion. Doesn't have a prophet. Buddhism, Jainism, and Sikhism, these three Eastern religions, they're founded in India. Buddhism, I see here in America, Buddhism is getting popular. I have many Buddhist friends in Kansas. Jainism is another ancient religion, and we have a Jain community there in Kansas, and they consider themselves as a part of the Hindu community. And there is a sizable Sikh community in the United States. And Sikhism, of course, was founded by Guru Nanak about 600 years ago. So compared to Buddhism and Jainism is more recent religion. But the Sikhs, probably you can identify the Sikhs, you know, the people wearing turban and a beard. So they are Sikhs. They are very religious people. In Kansas City, I think there are about 1,000 families Sikh. Okay, but you know, they have many commonalities with Hinduism, these three religions. But there are some differences too. Now, I said we don't know when Hinduism was started. But we do know that Hinduism comes from Vedas. Vedas are the ancient scriptures of the Hindus. And the composers of the Vedas were Vedic sages. And these Vedic sages used to do throughout their lives, they used to do meditation. And through meditation, they could communicate with God. And they could receive God's commands. And those commands were composed in the Vedas. And we Hindus call, Hinduism is a very common term. We all use, our religion is what? Hinduism. But in our scripture, we call this religion as eternal religion. Sanatan Dharma in Sanskrit. Why eternal? Because we believe that the spiritual laws that are in our scriptures, they are eternal in nature. They're eternal in nature. It's just that 5,000 years ago, Vedic sages, they discovered those laws through meditation and communication with God. But these laws are eternal. Okay, let me briefly talk about Hindu scriptures. We have two classes of scriptures. We have principal scriptures and the auxiliary scriptures. Principal scriptures are Vedas. Vedas are the principal scriptures. They are the revealed scriptures. They are books of revelation. They are words of God. Holy sacrosanct, primary, they are considered as primary scriptures and the most authoritative scriptures of the Hindus, Vedas, they are called the principal scriptures. In addition to these, we also have a separate set of scriptures. They are called auxiliary scriptures. Now, these scriptures were composed at a later stage, probably about 2,000 years ago, 2,000 to 2,500 years ago. And these scriptures are in the form of stories and illustrations. Like Puranas, there are some of the auxiliary scriptures. Ramayana, Mahabharata, they are very popular Hindu scriptures, they're auxiliary scriptures. Now, because these scriptures were written in stories and illustrations, it became more appealing, Hinduism became more appealing to masses. So Hinduism became popular through these auxiliary scriptures, and that was really the purpose of these auxiliary scriptures, is to make this Hinduism more popular and understandable to the people. Like in Bible, there are many Bible stories which are told in order to reveal the truth in Bible. So same way, the auxiliary scriptures were written to reveal the truth of Vedas, that was in Vedas. So Bhagavad Gita is the most popular scripture. Have you heard of Bhagavad Gita? Yes. Most Hindus keep a copy of Bhagavad Gita. I have several copies of Bhagavad Gita in my home. I gave one to my son and my daughter-in-law, and you have it. I have seen this book. Okay, good. All right. Vedas, yes. Now there are four Vedas, Rig, Sam, Yajur, Atharva. And Rig Veda is the earliest. Rig Veda was, as I said before, Rig Veda was composed about 5,000 years ago. But initially it was transmitted orally from generation after generation. And maybe about 3,000 years ago, when Sanskrit was developed and refined, so all the scriptures were in written form. Now, there are four Vedas, Rig, Sam, Yajur, Atharva, as I said. And each Veda has two sections. First part is Karma Kand, which is the work section. And the later part is the knowledge section. Gyanakand, we call Gyanakand. Now, in Karmakand, there are several subsections, like Sanghita, Brahmano, Arannaka. Sanghita is a prayer book. We pray to different forms of God. So these are this prayer book. And Brahmano is, in Brahmano, we find what we should do in our daily life to purify our heart. What are the different things we should do? So it's a rituals, different rituals that are prescribed in Vedas for our daily life. And Arannaka is also ritualistic, but it has more spiritual explanation of why we do this kind of ritual. Okay, now the knowledge section, this was composed at a later stage of Vedas. That is why they are called Vedanta, end of Vedas. That means these knowledge sections, there's separate scripture knowledge section. Actually, there are 108 scriptures in knowledge section, and they are called Upanishad. So knowledge section scriptures, they are called Upanishad, and they are really the philosophical part of Hinduism. Questions like, what is God? What is this universe? Who are we? What's our relationship with God? This kind of philosophical questions were answered in the knowledge section of Vedas. And I am more interested in the knowledge section of Vedas. I have several copies of Upanishads that I study regularly. So knowledge section is more philosophical. And I will be talking today, the rest of this, my time, 12 o'clock, is that? Okay. About the knowledge section. First, the concept of God in Hinduism. There is one word in Upanishad that is ekameva dityam. What that means is God is one and only one. Adityam means there is no second God. So God is one and only one. But we also say that God has many attributes and manifestations. Now, God is existence, consciousness, bliss. In Sanskrit, it's called Sat, Chit, Ananda. Infinite existence, infinite consciousness, infinite bliss. Now, what do these all mean? It means that God is the ultimate reality. God is the absolute reality. Nothing else is real. God is real. Absolute reality. Ultimate reality. God is infinite consciousness. God is an infinite ocean of consciousness. And God is bliss. Why God is bliss? Because those who have experienced God in their lives, they all stated that there is an immense amount of bliss that they feel when they experience God in meditation or whichever way, through different paths. If they experience God, they feel immense amount of bliss in their heart. So our sages call that God is infinite bliss. God is the Supreme Soul. Now, Paramatma in Sanskrit. Why God is Supreme Soul? We all have souls. And all these souls come from God. And I will talk about this in the next slide. So God is the Supreme Soul. All our souls come from God. Three manifestations of God. Oh, no. God can be personal as well as impersonal. Impersonal as well as personal. Now, impersonal God is Brahman, personal God is Ishvara. Now, this is somewhat confusing. I agree, this is somewhat confusing. How can God be impersonal and personal at the same time? Now, our rishis had the answer. This is why impersonal God is Brahman, and that is God. Impersonal God. But for ordinary people like us, you know, with our limited faculty, it is very difficult, almost impossible, to conceive something which is impersonal, infinite, eternal, and so forth. So Vedic sages realized that, and they realized that some form has to be given to the formless, so that the people, ordinary people, like us, we can connect to God, we could relate to God. So we have forms, we have all different forms, manifestations, there are different manifestations of God. So through these forms, we can connect to God. Now, if you come to our temple, You will see on one side in Temple in Kansas, if you you will see one feminine figure we worship as goddess Mother Saraswati, and she represents God's knowledge. So we worship her to get knowledge. And on the other side, there is another feminine figure with 10 hands and holding different swords and other arms. And she was riding a tiger and all that. What does it represent? It represents God's power. So we worship that form to get power. So all these forms that we worship, they are just forms. They are just forms. They are icons. They are not idols. Now, what is the difference between icon and idol? Idol, you stop there. An icon is transparent, so you see through that. So in other words, what I'm trying to say is when we worship a particular form, we worship God through this form, so that we can connect to God. And I tell my Christian friends, I go to your church and pray, but if there is a statue of Jesus on the cross, then I can probably connect to God more easily than I would connect without anything. You know, this is the idea. So we worship many different forms, but we worship one God through these forms. Make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Then the three manifestations of God, Brahma, Vishnu. Brahma is God of creation, Vishnu is the God of preservation, and Maheshwar is, or Shiva, God of dissolution. Now, so these are the three main manifestations of God. Now, what does it mean? It means that only God is the ultimate reality. Everything else in this world will go through its cycle of creation, preservation, and dissolution. So nothing is permanent, nothing is absolute, nothing is eternal except God, Brahman. And Brahma is the presiding deity of that creative aspect of God. Vishnu is the presiding deity of the preservative aspect of God. And Shiva or Maheshwar is the presiding deity of the dissolution aspect of God. God is everlasting and the ultimate reality. That's the last one. Yes, ultimate reality. The material world and everything in it, though a creation of God, God created this universe. We believe in that, but it's cyclical. It will go through its life cycle of creation, preservation, and dissolution. Now, you know, in our concept, in Hinduism, there is no end time. There is no end time. Time is cyclical. Universe will be dissolved at one time, and then again, it will be in latent stage for some time, and God will recreate the universe again. That's what we believe. And then that will be preserved for some time, and that will again be dissolved. And this will go on eternally. This cycle of creation, preservation, and dissolution will go on eternally. That's our belief. There's no end time. Okay, now I will go to another important slide. Can you all follow me? Okay, thank you. Okay, fundamental precepts of Hinduism, fundamental teachings, yes. Now, divinity of soul, to me, that's perhaps the most important teaching of our faith. Divinity of soul. What does it mean? It means that there is divinity. Our soul is divine. Because our soul is divine, soul is immortal, soul is pure, soul is perfect. So in our inside, there is something which is eternal, which is pure, which is perfect. Now the question somebody may ask, then why do we do, some of us, bad things? If we are so pure, if we are so perfect, if we are so divine in our heart, why do we do sometimes bad things? So our sages, they realized that this question would come. So they answered that. They said that there is always a cloud of ignorance that covers our inner divinity. We are ignorant of the fact that we are divine in our innermost soul. And that is why we do sometimes bad things. Now, once we can remove this ignorance, then we will realize our real nature. That is why we call soul as self, self. Our real self is divine. So, if we realize that we have divinity in ourselves, we'll be a completely different person. Then we will see divinity in all of us. And then we'll be a different person. And this stage is called self-realization. Self-realization. So the goal of life is to realize that you have divinity in yourself. Once you realize that, you'll be an entirely different person. You will treat others differently. So divinity of soul, to me, is a very important teaching of Hinduism. Now, I recall a few years ago, I was telling this to a gathering like this, and somebody raised her hand, and she said, if I'm not a Hindu, am I still have divinity in me? What's the answer? Yes. 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 It doesn't matter what you believe in. It even doesn't matter whether you believe in God or not. You may be an atheist person, but still you have divinity. And the goal of life is to realize that divinity. How? Our Bhagavad Gita tells how. Okay, let me go to the other 10 more minutes. Unity of existence. Unity of existence because we know God created this universe, so God's hand is everywhere. So everything is God's creation. So there is a fundamental unity in everything. So we call unity of existence. Oneness of Godhead. God is one, Brahman, one and only one. No second God. But there are many manifestations of God. Harmony of religion is something that I'm very proud of. We Hindus believe that all religions have their own path, which are true. You have your path, I have my path, he has his path, he has his maybe different path. But all these paths are true. So, really, I don't need to convert you to my path because you have your path. So all these paths lead to the same summit. So I don't need to convert you. I want you to be a better Christian if you're a Christian. I want to be a better Hindu myself. There's no need for me to convert you. So the harmony of religion is something that really I'm very proud of. That there is not just one path. There are many paths to God. You follow your path. Law of karma and reincarnation. You know, you heard of karma and reincarnation. We Hindus believe in reincarnation. That basically, you know, our soul being immortal, soul cannot die. When the body dies, body goes to earth. So body has no value. That's why we cremate. We don't preserve the body because it has no value. Soul has value, but soul already leaves. Soul leaves the body when a person dies. And then soul re-enters into a new body. And that is the reincarnation, theory of reincarnation. We believe in reincarnation. And this cycle of birth, death, and rebirth will go on and on and on until such time our soul unites with eternal soul, supreme soul, God, which is really the aim, goal of our life, is to be a self-realized person when you are living, and then after death, your soul will unite with the eternal soul. And that is our salvation. We call liberation, because now we are liberated from the chain of birth, death, rebirth. So that's why we call this as mukti. In Sanskrit, we call mukti. In English, it's liberation. Same as salvation. Nirvana, which Buddhists call as nirvana. Okay, so law of karma says that if you do good karma, then your next birth will be better. I would define that as a spiritually better. You'll be a better person spiritually in your next life if you do good karma, good work. Now, karma here means not just what you have done, but your intention and your thoughts. Thoughts and intentions, they are part of your karma. If I have some good thoughts, but I have not been able to do good to others, but I want to do good to others, that's a good karma. That will add to my good karma at the time of death. Same way, if I have bad thoughts, I want to harm someone, but that fellow is clever, he avoids me, so I couldn't do any harm. But my intention was bad, so that adds to our bad karma. So what I want to say, karma is not just what you have done, but our thoughts and intentions are also part of karma. Now, unfortunately, to talk about 5,000 old religion in 25 minutes or 35 minutes is difficult. So how many minutes I have? Okay. Theory of creation and concept of Maya. You know, you probably have heard Maya. Maya has been defined in different ways. Maya, generally, the ignorance I talked about, that's also considered as Maya. Because we are under the influence of Maya, We don't realize God. We don't realize the divinity in ourselves. And Shankaracharya is a Hindu saint, 8th century. He defined Maya in a little different way. He said that suppose there is a just ordinary rope, coil of rope, on the road, let's say, and it's dark, and you are walking along the road. Then suddenly you saw that coil of rope. What would be your reaction? Oh, that's a snake. You will think it's a snake. It's not a snake, it's a rope. But because of the darkness, you see that as a snake. Now, when the daylight comes, everything is bright, then you know it's not a snake, it's... So your reaction will be different. So he said, because of our ignorance, we react differently. I'm reacting to you, because of my ignorance, I'm reacting to you in a way, but if I am a self-realized person, I will react to you in a completely different way. I will recognize that you have divinity. So, theory of creation, this concept of Maya has been defined in several ways. Also, there is another theory that God, when God created the universe, he created this universe with a mysterious power of Maya. And that is why we think that everything will last forever. All these things, properties that we have made and all these things will last forever. But that's not true. And this is because of the concept of Maya. Okay, I can go to the next one. Fundamental practice of Shubha, what do you say? Go. Okay, there are fundamental practices of Hinduism, and I will go through these if you allow me to, because I know that. Okay, four stages of life and four pursuits of life. Now, four stages of life, and this was primarily true during the Vedic time, ancient life. It's not true in today's life. Okay, let me describe this. Four stages of life. Each life is about 25 years. Each stage is about 25 years. So first we have a student life. And in student life, study, learn. That's the only thing. We say in Sanskrit, chatranam adhyanam tapah, which means for the student, to study is the main thing. Nothing else. Study. So student life is study, life of study. Then at age 25, student becomes a householder, gets married, and then have children and raise children and all that. So that's another 25 years. And then the stage comes from retirement for spiritual pursuits. So at the age of about 50, then a person understands that you know, now it's time has come. I've done my duty, you know, my kids are all grown up, I've done my duty. Now the stage has come that I study some scriptures. So go to some wooded area and study scriptures and see what it says, and for next 25 years, up to 75 years. And then renunciation, that's the last stage of life. Then a person realizes that now the time has come that I have to go to God. So, renunciation means no more attachment to the material things. So what in ancient time they used to leave home, husband, wife, maybe if wife is still living at that time, they all, or husband was still living at that time. They go somewhere in, maybe at the foothill of Himalayas or some solitary places, and used to spend the rest of their life in meditation. So that is the renunciation, no more attachment. And Gita, Bhagavad Gita also talks about detachment. Detachment, develop the habit of detachment. And that one way to go to God is to don't have any desire for material goods. Have your desire only for God. No material things. So that the renunciation stage. Okay, four stages of life, and the next one, I will finish there. Four pursuits of life. Now, four pursuits of life is, first is the perhaps the most important, which is dharma. We call dharma. What is dharma? Dharma sometimes translated as religion. But dharma to us is more than religion. Dharma means the upholding righteousness, yes. Moral and ethical values. We have to respect the moral and ethical values. No matter what you do, we have to be within the boundaries of moral and ethical values. And duties. See, duties are also an important part of dharma to us. Duties to myself, duties to my family, duties to my community, and duties to my nation. All these duties are part of my dharma, religion. So in Hinduism, actually religion has much wider perspective. Now, then we have money. Now, what does money has to do in the pursuits of life? Yes, it is necessary. We have to earn money, particularly in the householder stage of life. We have to earn money. But you have to be careful that we earn money in an honest way. Always be within the boundary of moral and always be within the moral and ethical boundaries. Don't steal or rob or something. In a dishonest way, don't earn money. So money is a pursuit of life, but within the boundaries. Same way, sensual pleasure. God has given us senses. There's absolutely nothing wrong in using senses for our pleasure. But be careful, be careful. Always stay within the boundaries of dharma. Always stay within the boundaries of moral and ethical values. As long as we can do that, there's absolutely nothing wrong in enjoying sensual pleasure. And salvation is the last. Salvation is the goal of life. That the final pursuit of life is salvation, which I have talked about. I want to talk briefly about worship practices. We have worship practices, congregational practices, like we go in a church, in a temple, and the priest there, he performs all kinds of rituals, and he says mantras, and does some services for all of us. That's a congregational service. Okay, and we also have a private service. That is for a personal reason. Maybe we have a baby in the family, so we go to temple and get the God's blessing for the baby. So we take the baby, the priest offers some prayers and, you know, services for the baby. So we have this private services also. And also, I don't know whether you have any Hindu friend. In many Hindu houses, they have their own worship places, you know, their own personal, in the house. It could be in the basement, it could be an anteroom, or it could be in the closet, or someplace. You know, there's a shrine. And the Hindu family, they can put their favorite religious teacher, guru, or favorite deity, and then worship every day before going to work or after coming from work or something. So that in many Hindu families, you will see that they have a personal deity or their personal religious teacher, family guru, we call this picture or statue or something. And then we worship that every day. So that's also private worship. And Hindu greetings, last thing I want to talk about, Hindu greetings, you know how we do? Namaste. And it's the same way we offer prayer to a deity. You know, when we offer prayer, we just fold our hand, bow our head. That's the same way we greet you. Why? That is because when I greet you by namaste, I greet not just the body of your person, but your inner soul, which is divine. So I greet your inner soul when I greet you by saying namaste. So that is the Hindu greeting. And I think the time is up. And again, you know, it's really a challenge for me to talk about a religion in so short a time, in which is 5,000 years old. Okay, now I want to say a prayer before I finish. Om Sarvesham Shantir Bhavatu. Om Sarvesham Shastir Bhavatu. Om Sarvesham Purnam Bhavatu. Om Sarvesham Mangalam Bhavatu. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. The English translation will be, by the grace of God, let everybody have peace. Let everybody have auspiciousness. Let everybody have fulfillment. And let everybody have wellness. Peace, peace, peace. Namaste. So if you have any question, I'll be happy to respond to you maybe outside, right, Subha? Okay, thank you very much.